good afternoon. So, last time, we went over XV6's functions for manipulating page tables. We had this main function, walkPageDir, which sort of does manually what the hardware does when we access a virtual memory address. We get a virtual memory address, something that like a user normal program might access, and this function finds the second level page table entry for that address. And if we were doing a full access like the processor handles, it would look at that second level page table, figure out if it's valid, present, writable, if we're doing a write, accessible in user mode, if we're in user mode, and look up the physical page number from there, combine it with the page offset from the virtual address, and actually access memory. So walkPageDir doesn't do that last step, but it does all the steps beforehand. And it's given sort of to start out with, we give a pointer to the beginning of the first entry of the first level page table. And the way walkPageDir works, well, it's code in the kernel, so it's working with virtual addresses in that kernel part of memory. So remember, we had sort of our memory layout where we divided up our program's memory, where we had the halfway point was this was all kernel only, and the rest was the user part. So this is all using addresses in the user part, and taking advantage of the fact they map one-to-one to addresses in physical memory. So we have a pointer in there to a first level page table, we use that to find the second level page table, and get a pointer in that range of kernel virtual addresses to the second level page table and return the particular entry in there so that we can change it or modify it. And all the other functions we saw in XV6 for manipulating page tables are basically built off calling walkPageDir, getting this pointer that they can dereference to read or modify the page table entry and modifying it potentially. So we have map pages. So map pages is given a range of virtual addresses, which we get by a base virtual address and a size, and a range of physical addresses, where we get a base physical address, and the range goes from that to the same size. And it sets page table entries to point those virtual addresses to those physical addresses. How does it work? It calls walkPageDir in a loop. There's also some rounding, which I'll go through in a bit. And I mentioned that in stock XV6, this function also does some error checking in that in XV6 as it's written. Once a page table entry is set, we never set it to anything else, so it makes sure that we aren't setting a page table entry that's set to something else. Then using these, we have a couple functions. So we have allocKVM is the function that makes a new page table and also sets the kernel part. So that's the upper part of the page table is set. So this is part of making a new process. We need to be able to access all of the kernel's memory when we're switched to that process. And we need to have a template in which we're going to fill in with this other function, allocUVM, the user pages we're allocating, like for the user's code or data. So allocUVM, given a page table that's already been allocated, allocates some user pages. And for both of these functions, we need ways of actually allocating memory. And the way that's done is with this function kalloc and kfree. So kalloc, you know, kind of sounds like malloc, but unlike malloc, it doesn't take a size. It always allocates one page. How does it get the page? We have this just big linked list of pages that are available to use. That's set up at boot. Kalloc removes something from it. Kfree puts something back on it. So questions about these XV6 functions for manipulating page tables? I guess I didn't mention explicitly, so like allocKVM, allocUVM basically call map pages a bunch, which uses walkPageDir. So all of these functions end up just calling walkPageDir in loops, essentially. That is the way XV6 manages page tables. Questions? Okay, so now on map pages. So the way map pages works is, let's say this is our virtual addresses, and I make this map pages call here. So the arguments to map pages are a starting virtual address, a size, and a starting physical address. And also some flags to indicate writable, user accessible, and so on. So here, I'm specifying a starting virtual address of 4000, which is the beginning of virtual page 4. And I'm specifying a size of a page that's 4096 bytes. And so this is going to end up mapping virtual page 4 to physical page 50, Y50, because that's the address I specified here is the base address of that physical page. So that seems straightforward. And if I make the size bigger, I'm going to map two virtual pages. And I'm not going to map them both to page 50. I'm going to map them to two different things. So this function is kind of designed for setting up those kernel mappings, where we have this one-to-one mapping over this big region of memory, or for helping with loading stuff like from an executable. So the assumption is that if we have something loaded, we have it loaded across, you know, fit multiple physical pages potentially. That's what it's designed to handle. So something I want to point out, which is a point of a lot of confusion for people using this function on the upcoming assignment, is what happens if we supply a virtual address, which is in the beginning of a virtual page. So in that case, we're specifying a range of addresses that are crossing. In this case, my size is two pages, but the range of virtual addresses crosses three virtual pages. And if I want to map that whole range, well, I can't map, you know, all of a page but the first, 1,024 bytes, which is 0x400. I can't map all but the quarter of a page. There's no way of doing that. So what this function's going to do instead is it's going to map the first page, all of it, the second page, and the third page. And for something like loading an executable, where the executable might not start at the beginning of a page, this is some behavior that makes sense. So that's probably why it does this sort of thing. But that's the behavior we have, and this might not be what you expect. And this is generally a pattern we'll see, that when we want to do something to a program's memory on a unit of less than a page, well, we don't have that option. All we can tell the processor is change this whole virtual page. We can't change half of the virtual page. So we're going to end up doing things in whole pages, even when we might have preferred to do it in some other unit. And notice that the physical page numbers I've chosen in this case, you know, are corresponding to assuming that I have all the physical pages starting at this address to plus 2000. And if you didn't do that, well, this function is not gonna deal with, you know, handling that. And in particular, you know, it's just gonna end up mapping some things which are out of that range because it could only map a whole page. So questions about map pages? Yes?
The yellow outline is what we wanted to do, but the red one was what actually happened.
Question, the yellow outline is what we wanted to do, and the red outline is what actually happened. So I guess the yellow outline is what the argument seemed to say, and the red outline is what will happen. As for what you wanted it to do, hard to say. So I think in some like uses of this function, the reason it works this way, this is what was intended. Like for loading programs, this might be make more sense. Or loading the kernel, I guess, is the big thing. This might make more sense. Okay. Other questions? Okay, so that's our how map pages work. So last time when we finished up, we were mentioning about, we're looking at how the user part of memory is managed. So we learned that the kernel part of memory has this very static mapping. We learned how physical pages are allocated. We have this user part of memory, and we mentioned we have this weird layout where we have the stack in the middle and the guard page, and we have this heap. And this heap can change size. So how can it change size? Well, we're going to have some size, and this is in fact tracked explicitly by XV6 as the SZ for presumably size variable in each process control block. And we can adjust the size with the S break system call, S for break for set break. So this is the break between the end of the heap and this invalid section of memory. And when we move that break, of course, not only do we have to change the size variable, but we're going to actually allocate or deallocate memory. So every process has this heap at the top of its outer space, and note that kind of very deliberately, it turns out that every process has valid memory from address 0 to that size. Well, valid except for the garbage. And S-break changes the size, and S-break takes an amount, and it adds that amount to the size. The amount can be negative. If the amount's negative, we deallocate part of the heap. And this is the function that XV6 provides for chain allocating or deallocating heap space. You might say, what about malloc? How does malloc work? Malloc is going to be implemented using this. So a typical implementation of malloc is going to do something like call S-break to get, like, you know, say 16 kilobytes at a time, and then divide those 16 kilobytes up into whatever you're asking for. So if you're asking for like a 64-byte linked list node, it's going to give you 64-byte pieces of that, but it's going to get them in one big chunk from the kernel. And note that the way our page tables work, that practically speaking, well, the kernel can only really allocate a page at a time at minimum. So malloc kind of has to do that work, or something kind of has to do that work. And we've chosen in most OSs that the OS is not going to handle most of the work details of allocating objects. It's going to just provide this interface that libraries can use to actually handle the, you know, detailed division efficiently. We'll learn that on systems like Linux, which are a little more featureful than XV6, we'll have other functions other than S-break for allocating memory, but we're going to have the same sort of thing where they're not going to be the functions you actually want to use to like allocate a single object. And they're not going to correspond directly to any of the library functions you may have used, like malloc or new. So let's look at the implementation of S-break. So S-break, we take an argument n, we read through argint, we record the old size, and we call this growproc function. So we record the old size, and this is what we end up returning. So S-break returns the old end of the heap. You might say, why would this be useful? Well, this means that, for example, S-break of 0 is a way to query the current heap end, heap, and say S-break of 4096 gives you a pointer to 4096 bytes of new heap. And why is that? Because if we think of, we have our old heap, and we get the address of the old heap here, and we have the new 4096 we just added to it afterwards. So this is a convenient design for using that allocated memory. That's probably why they chose the API the way it is. But they could have, of course, made some other choices. But this is sort of the traditional Unix choice. So the interesting thing is this growproc function, of course. That seems to be doing all the work here. You notice that it can fail. So failing is like if we're out of memory, that it can fail. But otherwise, it's going to grow the heap by n or shrink it by n, where n is negative. So let's look at that function. So this is growproc. And growproc is going to take our current process, we're going to record its size, and we're going to call either allocUVM to allocate more memory based on allocating between the old and new size. We're going to call deallocUVM to deallocate some memory. And allocUVM and deallocUVM both return the new size, or a zero if they fail, like we're out of memory, or something else goes wrong. And then growproc sets the new size to the size allocUVM or deallocUVM computed. We also have this switchUVM function I'll get to a little later. So alloc EVM is going to be, again, a loop that calls kalloc. So it's going to allocate for each of the pages in that page. Okay. So let's mention about this switch UVM here. So in the case where we're deallocating pages, there's some page table entries which previously were valid, which become invalid. And there's some special considerations we have to take to do that. And one issue we have to deal with is that the processor has a cache of page table entries. And it would seem like, oh, we set the page table entry to null, like to invalid, so that should update the cache to know that that memory isn't allocated. That is not how processors work. So processors have usually made a design decision where they said, having our page table cache automatically update when the OS changes the page table sounds complicated. What we're going to do instead is we're going to tell the OS that you are responsible for telling us when you change page table entries so we can update our cache. And so that's why the switch UVM is there. So when you change the page table base register, which is what switch UVM does, which is part of the context switch that sets the address space for a process, as part of changing the page table base registers, it removes anything that has cached about the page table. So by resetting the page table base register, we clear out an x86 processor's cache about it, and this is how the processor knows that page table entries may have changed and avoids using cached ones. You might say, maybe there's a more efficient way of doing that, absolutely, than just clearing all the entries, but that's not something that XP6 handles. So that's why we have that switch UVM in there. So questions about that? So this is sort of clear cached page table entries. So this is, you know, reset. So processors, page table, base register, the clear cache page table entries in the processor. Questions? Okay. So we've talked about allocating space on the heap. Let's talk about what happens with this invalid region up here. What happens when we access that? So that's something that's just going to be marked as not present, the page table, and that's going to trigger a page fault. That's in the type of exception, and it's handled in XP6's trap function. And if you look in the trap function, and you look for code that handles page faults, well, you're not going to find any. So it goes into the default case in XP6's trap function. So let's say we do something to trigger a page fault. So here, I have some code where I take this address here, which is very likely to be above that heap region, in that invalid space between the end of the heap and the beginning of the kernel's memory. And I make a pointer to it, and I turn this address into a pointer, and I dereference that pointer. So I'm trying to read an integer from that invalid memory. I'm trying to write an integer, trying to write one, in fact, into an integer in an invalid space. So this is going to crash. But it's going to trigger a page fault, and the XP6 is going to handle this page fault, and the code that XP6 has to handle it has this printf, which prints out a bunch of information, and then it marks the process as killed. So let's look at the information that gets printed out. There's a bunch of things here. So we have the PID, the program's name. We also have this trap number. So this is a number chosen by the processor to identify the type of exception. And it happens that Intel has chosen number 14 for page faults. So if we see 14, that's a page fault. We also have some useful information, which is this register CR2. So RCR2 stands for read register CR2. CR2 is control register 2. And it happens to contain the faulting address, meaning the address the program was trying to access when the page fault happened. Why is this called control register 2 and not something better? I don't know. That is the choice that Intel made. So that contains our faulting address, which we could use to do something perhaps better to handle this page fault. We also have some other information. So like we have EIP here, which is the address of the instruction that triggered the fault. So that's the move instruction, presumably, that's trying to move one into this invalid memory location. We have an error code from the CPU, which if we read Intel's manuals, we could figure out maybe a little more information about what the program was trying to do from that. Some other information. So right now, the way we're handling page faults is very boring and simple. We're just killing the program after printing out a message, which we can interpret to figure out what was going on, but it's not extremely intuitive. So we don't have to crash, though. So something we could do instead of crashing from trap is rather than just printing out a message and crashing, we could update the page table and return. And when we return from a page fault handler, what's going to happen is the processor is going to go back to the same instruction that triggered the fault, and it's going to run it again. And if we updated the page fault page table, that instruction might work this time without triggering a page fault. So we can use this to do just-in-time updates of a process memory. We're going to go through an example of not allocating memory until a program needs it. Sort of a motivation for this. So the general pattern we're going to have is that we're going to have our trap handler. We're going to, when a page fault happens, we're going to retrieve the address that triggered it. So in XV6's case, this is the RCR2. So this is the address that triggered the fault. Triggered fault. So what the program was trying to access. Program was trying to access. And we can look up whether that address is something we want to allow the program to access. And if so, well, the program couldn't access it because the page table wasn't set up correctly. There's something missing from the page table. We can fix that and return. And the program should be able to go on normally. And as far as the program's concerned, well, this access just worked. It was just a little weird and slow, right? Because from the program's perspective, it just ran that instruction and it happened. What really happened is that it ran that instruction once, the kernel ran that instruction again, and then it worked. But all the program can really tell is that it's slower. And if it's something the program's not allowed to access, we can go back to our default behavior of printing out a message and killing the program. And this means that we're going to have some separate way of tracking whether memory is accessible to the program. So rather than having the page table tell us what memory is set up for a program, we're going to have some other data structure that tracks that. And we're also going to do the operation of like actually setting up the memory as late as possible, just before the program needs it, at least in some cases. Some questions about this sort of general idea of doing something to set up page tables on a page fault. Okay. So we're going to do lots of things, and lots of real OSs do lots of different things, which I'll call page table tricks, where what processes think they have in memory is not what they really have allocated. It's not what's in the page table. And we're using the page fault handler to fix this disagreement. So one, as I mentioned, we're going to talk about allocating space on demand. So use case for this is we think of a system like Linux. You can write programs and run them on, say, a Linux or probably a Windows system that like use lots of stack space, that like do thousandfold deep recursion. And that means that they use lots and lots of stack space. But most programs don't do that. Most programs only need a modest amount of stack space. So it seems like to support those programs that do thousandfold deep recursion, that an operating system is going to need to allocate a huge amount of stack space, even though most of the time it's going to turn out that only a little bit of that's going to be used. And we'd like to avoid that, and we can use this technique of fixing things up in page faults to fix that. So what we can do is we can decide we're not going to actually allocate the space, and we're going to just let the program run. And let's say our program here does something that ends up needing more stack space than we allocated in advance. Well, that's going to trigger a page fault because we haven't allocated the space, so the page table says that there's nothing there. And as far as the processor is concerned, there's nothing there. And we need to know, okay, a page fault happened. Let me look at the address the program is trying to access. Oh, that's something I promised the program was at stack. So the processor doesn't think anything's there, but we know we wanted the program stack to be there, even though we haven't allocated it yet. So we're going to say, I promised the program stack should be there. So let's make that happen. So we'll allocate some more stack space, update the page table to point to it, and return. And then the program will just run as normal with its newly allocated memory. And as far as the program's execution, it's as if we allocated that space in advance. The only difference the program can see is that the performance is different, right? That rather than spending time up front allocating it, we spent time in the middle of the program allocating that space. So questions on this allocate on demand idea? Okay, so this idea of allocating space on demand, this is done all over the place by real OSs. And this is done for like new heap allocations, initially zero global variables. And also we do something similar for loading a program. So for loading a program, you know, we're gonna load it on demand. So why would you do this? You know, a big reason is, even if you're sure you're going to need the space, if I'm running a program and I want to start it, I can just load the things it needs to start. And I can worry about loading the rest later. So doing this sort of strategy dramatically speeds up how quickly we can start a program. It means we're probably spending more time overall loading things for the program because we're doing it in like smaller chunks, so less efficiently. But we can do it while the program's running already. This is something that OSs generally will do. This is generally how they'll set up memory for programs in general, not just their stack, but also like heap memory and code and so on. They'll allocate the space on demand and possibly load a copy of it on demand from the executable rather than doing it all in advance, because it makes the program sort of start faster, even though, yes, overall, we might be spending a little extra time doing the loading. But for most programs, that's kind of free because the program's not going to like use all the CPU in the middle anyways. We have some kind of spare time for free. Okay. The upcoming paging protection assignment, the first part of it, is going to be to add allocating on demand just for the heap to XV6. So what you're going to end up doing is we're going to have our separate call, and rather than allocating right away, it's just going to adjust the heap location without changing anything, but you're going to change things in the page fault handler. Okay, so we've talked about allocating on demand. Let's do a little exercise here. So here, let's say I have this program, and that when we enter the foo function, we have our stack pointer. And let's say this is at the beginning of a page. So that's the sort of assumption here. The stack pointer is a multiple of a page size. And we allocate space using that for array, which is a 128 kilobyte array. And I have this loop that actually accesses the array. And let's say this is all allocated on demand. My question is, how much space will we actually allocate, assuming we allocate as little as possible? So something you might observe is you might say, I showed you an example like where we're allocating stack on demand and we allocate one page of stack at a time. You might say, wouldn't it be faster to like allocate a couple just to avoid the overhead later? And the answer is probably yes. Let's ignore that for now. Even though, yes, that's a reasonable strategy for OS to implement. Let's assume we do the minimum possible. Who'd like some more time? Okay. No problem. Okay, so okay, so who thinks A, B, C, D, E, okay, F, okay, G, H, I, something else? One of those? Okay, a couple. Okay, so we have sort of a split between E and F. Does anyone want to volunteer how they got their answer? Or how you would start on the problem, at least. What? No one wants to say. Yeah.
I started by thinking about there's only going to be eight array axes.
Okay, so you said first we looked at where's the array axis, and you said there's eight array axes. Yep. Yeah. You have one with 0, one with 16k, one with 32k, and so on is the index.
From there, I was kind of confused if it would allocate all of those to like one page table and somehow track what the index is in the array. I didn't think that was the case, so I just assumed that each access would require like its own page table.
Okay, so you said you were wondering how this corresponded to page tables. So note that each of these array indices has a particular virtual address. Right, so let's say this is like, the beginning of the array is like actually, probably at the bottom here. Where is my cursor? Thank you. Is at the bottom here, right? So this is let's say OX, let's say this is 8000. This might be array 0, right? And then OX 800 plus 16k, so OX 8400 would be array of 16k. So that makes sense. So each of the array elements is going to have a particular virtual address, and we have the same page table lookup we've seen before, and that's going to determine where page table entries for all of them are. The question's asking about physical memory for the array. I didn't intend to include space for page tables in there. Yes, there might be some cases where we need a new second level page table, but I don't think we have enough information to really know that because it depends on whether we can share the page table with the rest of the stack, which usually we can, but depending on whether we're at the edge of the range covered by one of those first level page table entries, maybe not. Right, because remember, those entries span a really large range. But when we access 0, we're going to have an access for a particular place. And in order to make that access work, we need to have a page table entry for it. And when we have a page table entry for it, we're going to have to set that page table entry to point to a valid page. So if we remember our locator on demand, if we think here, we previously had something that was invalid, and we have to make it valid, right, for the array access. Here it's a push, but there it's an array access. We're going to have to make that whole page valid. And that means that we're going to allocate a page here. We're going to allocate 4,096 bytes, because that's the only thing we can tell the processor about. We have to tell the processor, here's a whole page of memory for the program. We can't tell it, here's a byte of memory for the program, even though a byte is all the program's using. So we're going to allocate a page for here, and we're going to do the same thing for 4K. And if these were addresses were closer together, well, it'd end up being the case that we'd allocate a page for 0, and for example, that means that if we access 10, we wouldn't have a problem, right? That would already be allocated. But unfortunately, these accesses are very far away from each other, so they're all going to require new pages. None of them can share the pages that they got. And as you mentioned, we have 8 of them, so that's 8 times 4k. So I would get F from that. So this is 8 times 4K. So we have 8 accesses, 2 places in the middle of the array. They're all very far apart from each other relative to our page size, so each of them needs a page to be allocated. Because the page is the minimum we can do to actually make the processor make the access work. Even though we can't tell the processor, assign a quarter of this page or something like that, there's no way of saying that in the page table. Questions about my reasoning for here? Okay. And the subtle thing here is that I used this assumption that the stack pointer was originally at the beginning of a page to assume that like the array of 0 and the end of the things in my array definitely didn't share any pages with other parts of the stack that might be in use. Because if that were the case, maybe I would have avoided like a page fault for address 0 because like maybe I was stored just before it. But we know that that can't be the case. They have to be on separate pages because of the alignment. Or we assume they should be because of the alignment. But if they weren't, we'd have this case where like maybe I is on a page of the stack that's the same as array of 0, in which case accessing I would allocate array of 0, even though they're separate variables. Like all the processor knows is here's a whole page. Okay, so other questions, comments? Okay, so this was allocating on demand. So that's one of many sort of weird things we can do with page table tricks. And so far we've just seen stuff that's based on having pages that aren't present, making them present. There's other things we can do. We're going to look back at fork. So remember when we talked about fork, one of the things fork does is it makes a copy. And that seemed ridiculously inefficient. And one of the reasons it seemed ridiculously inefficient is that our common case, like when we were writing our shell, is that we fork, we do a very little amount of work, and then we'd exec, getting rid of that whole copy we made, essentially. And an observation we can make is that we don't actually need to make a real copy. So one way we can save space is let's look at, this is a typical on like Linux program layout. We have our stack. We have our code, we have our data, we have our heap. And the code, well, the code we can actually not copy. How can we not copy the code? Well, nothing should be writing the code in the constants. So we can just have it shared read-only. And we can enforce that in our page table. So remember, we have our PTEW flag. And if the PTEW flag's not set, if a program tries to use that page table entry to access something for writing, it's going to fail. So we can prevent writing, so we can share these code and constants that will never be written for free. But it seems like we can't use the same trick for, say, the global variables. It seems like the global variables, well, the program's going to modify them probably, or might modify them. We can't make them not writable, or else the program can't execute correctly after we fork. But typically, we've learned that, you know, typically after forking, you're just like doing a small amount of work and then execing. So typically, actually, it could be shared, right? Typically, we aren't changing the global variables, so there'd be nothing wrong with sharing them. The problem is that sometimes that's wrong. Sometimes we actually need to make a copy. But typically, we don't. And the problem is that we need a way of detecting, are we in the case where we need to make a copy or not? And we can do that. We can detect when the program tries to modify it because we have that mechanism where we can make memory read-only for the program. We can mark something in the page table as read-only, then the CPU is going to enforce that for us. So when the program tries to write to that memory, it will trigger a page fault. And just like for the allocate on demand case, we don't need to look at that page fault and say, gosh, the program screwed up. We can say, okay, let's see what the program thinks about this memory. Oh, the program thinks this memory is some global variables that it can write to. Let me make sure so that's actually the case. And just like with the allocate on demand, where we said the program thinks this memory is part of its stack it can use, let's make it so that's actually accessible, we can do the same thing for these global variables. We can make a copy that's independent when it tries to use it. So this gives a scheme we'll call copy on write. So how does that look? So let's say I'm running a program here, and this is just part of the second level page tables I've written out. When this program forks, I'm going to make a new page table for the child process. And what I'm going to do in that process is I'm going to change both page tables. I'm going to make the parent page table all read-only. And I'm going to make a new child page table that's the same as the parent page table, including being all read-only. And if the program isn't changing any part of its memory, both of these programs will execute fine. There's no problem. They can use this. They'll have this copy of the same data. It will be just what fork is supposed to do, except we haven't allocated nearly as much memory. Like, all we allocated memory for was a new page table. So where a problem comes in is that, well, we were kind of assuming the program won't access most of the memory, but we know it's going to access some of it, right? If you think of your shell, like, you fork, and then you like look at a few variables, do a little bit of work, you're not going to access most of this memory, but you're going to change a few things. So we need to handle those few things. And the observation we can make is that, let's say our child process tries to, say, write to a global variable on virtual page 605. Well, that's going to trigger a fault. In x86, I should say, it's a page fault. They just happen to use the same type. Some other systems might be a protection fault. But it's going to trigger a fault. It's going to run the OS. And the OS, rather than responding to that fault by saying, this program screwed up, I killed it, we can say, OK, I promised this program that this memory was a copy. Let's make that true now so we don't get in trouble. So at this point, we make a copy. So we've made a copy. So as part of making a copy, we have a new physical page that we made a copy into. And we also set it as writable. And we rerun the write instruction by returning from the page fault handler. So questions about this copy on write process? Okay, so let's say I've done this in the child process, and let's say the parent program tries to write to the same place. What should happen? What's going to happen? Anyone? So the parent program, so this is my, I should label these. So this is my child page table, and this is my parent page table. And let's say the parent process also decides to write to the same global variable. What should end up happening as a result of that? Anyone? Yeah?
You have to make one of the two a copy, and I guess the design decision is due to your access.
So the question is, we have to make one of the two a copy? So I'm assuming, so just, I guess I didn't make my scenario clear enough. So this is after we do this stuff for the child, the parent tries to write to the same place. So what should happen? Yeah, I was hoping for other volunteers. Thanks, other people. Yeah. Or what's the first thing that should happen?
Well, it should be mapped to a different page table than the child's is.
The parent should have a different page table than the child? Yes. So this is the parent's page table here, and this is the child's. So the parent is, in fact, now different for this. So that's good. So the parent. So let's say the parent tries to write to that virtual page. What's going to happen? What's the first thing that's going to happen as a result of that? Yes.
A page fault.
Yes. So we're going to have. It's trying to write. The page table says it can't write. Okay. So then the question is, what should the operating system do based on that page fault? And there are multiple possible options we have. Someone give me one of them. So we're trying to write, the parent process is trying to write to the same place the child was. We have a page fault because right here, this is not writable. So what should happen? I'll circle that. So that's not writable. So we have a page fault. Right. Page fault. And what should the page fault handler do? Anyone. So, who thinks it should not kill the program? Okay, so we're in agreement on that part. And we probably want to go back to the same instruction, so we better do something to that page table entry in the page fault handler. Yes?
To make it writable?
So make it writable. Is that, so that's it? Okay, so making it writable, yeah, so that's fine. It's not that there's some hidden bookkeeping we need here. So we need to know, could make it just writable. Could make it writable. Writable as long as it's no longer shared. So in addition to keeping track of whether the memory is really supposed to be writable, we also have to know, you know, is it shared or not, really? We have to keep track of that information as it changes somehow. And this is something modern neurons do. So we're going to have a whole bunch of data structures outside of the page table, because the page table is just what the processor cares about. But we have a bunch of extra bookkeeping to do in order to make sure we can track things properly. In particular, one other thing we need to do is, let's say the parent process exits. We need to know which pages can we free. So we need to track that sort of information. Or if the child process exits, we need to know which pages we can free. And it, you know, it's not clear immediately what that answer is unless we have some extra bookkeeping to know, oh, you know, I can't free this page because the parent's still using it. So there's a whole bunch of extra bookkeeping involved here, even though the fundamental idea is just that we remember what we promised to the program and we make sure that that's actually true on a page fault, even though we didn't set it up in advance. So we pretended we made a copy, but we didn't actually, but we'll fix that pretending to making a real copy when the program tries to write to the copy, when either one tries to write. And therefore, we'll make a copy by the time the program cares about it, because the only time the program can care about the copy being made is when someone modifies the copy. Some questions, comments? Okay, so let's do a little exercise here. So here, I have a memory layout for a program. We have some code, we have some global variables, we have some heap, we have some stack. And I'm saying that my program calls fork, and then the child does some writes. It writes to overwrite an array on the heap, and to modify a variable in the stack. And I'm asking, let's assume that, you know, we're not, that after all this happens, everything that the programs can read is accessible without a page fault, meaning that we aren't doing any allocate on demand. If it happened, it's already done. So the question is, how much has to be allocated for all our data and code to make that happen, to make it so everything that the programs can read is readable without a page fault? Everything that's readable is allocated. Okay, so to get started, let's start with how much needs to be allocated for just the code part of memory. So we have just, to start out, let's just ask this question about how much needs to be allocated so they can read just this code part of memory in the parent and child. So how many physical pages do we need for that? So let's see. So who thinks we need 1, 2 people, 3, 4 No answer? Okay, so this code. So first of all, let's start with, not sure where people are confused. So first of all, so this range of code memory, so this that's a range of virtual addresses. How many pages is that? Tell me that. How many pages does that range cover? So we have our page size, we're told in the question, is 4 kilobytes. So that's 2 to the 12 bytes. So one thing we can think is that means that we're going to split our address up into a 12-bit page offset and a page number, whether it's virtual or physical. So if it's a 12-bit page offset, then the page offset must be 3 hex radits. So here, those are our page offsets. So this range is page number 1 to page number 2. So it's 2 virtual pages. So let's start with, before forking, how many physical pages were used to store that? So let's say, who thinks 1, 2? We have at least consensus on that we need 2 physical pages to store 1 copy of it. So the question is, how does that change after we fork? So who thinks that it, so let's see, so who thinks it gets bigger? Thinks it stays the same? Okay, so it stays the same. So this is stays the same after we fork, and why is this, can someone give me a reason why it should stay the same? Yeah.
Code's not gonna change, it's read only, so we share the process won't modify.
Yeah, so it's read only, so we can share it by just pointing to the same thing, and we don't have to worry about the program noticing it's not really a copy. Okay, so this is going to be 2 physical pages. Okay, so let's get to, how about our global variables? How many virtual pages are those? 1, okay, so we have 1 page here, 1 virtual page. Is this something that we're going to need to make an extra copy? So who thinks we're going to need more pages after forking? So there's 1 virtual page, 1 physical page before forking. So the question is, are we going to need more or less the same after forking? So who thinks we're going to need more pages after forking for the global variables? Who thinks we're going to need the same number? So we have a split here. Anyone want to defend an answer?
I think you need more because it's saying you're not allowed to have any page faults in the middle of the child process. So you have to create that copy.
Okay, so you're saying that if we don't have a copy, then if the child process or the parent process decides to access that to write to one of those, there's going to be a page fault. I agree. So I guess I wasn't careful enough about pointing out something that's, I know, buried in the middle of this question. But when only the count reading without page faults. So, yes, so if we were concerned about any page faults, that would indeed be the case. I tried to not, yeah, I should have emphasized that, but we only care about reading for this case. So indeed, if we need to write without page faults, we need a real copy. But if not, it's a different question. So then the question should be, so with that clarification, who thinks we want the same number? Okay, or more? Okay, so more? Okay, so a couple people say more. What's the reason for more? Or no?
Preventing page faults still.
Preventing page faults, so what page faults would you be worried about? Okay, so you're worried that that this variable is a global variable? Okay, so my intention here is on the stack means it's only on the stack. There's no intermediate on the heap that's written to. Okay, so I think, yeah, so my assumption would be that none of the stuff that we're dealing with writing touches that, so there's no difference, so it's still going to be one. So we can still share a copy because no one's changed anything. So how about the heap? So who thinks we need? So the heap is, this is two virtual pages. So who thinks we're going to need more than two physical pages for them after forking? Okay, thinks we're going to need this just exactly two physical pages? So most people say more. Okay. So who thinks we're going to need three physical pages after forking? Okay, a couple people. Who thinks four? Okay, more than four? Okay. So most people say three. You want to explain how we got three? Yeah.
Because you only need a copy, one extra page for the 128 bytes.
Okay, so you're saying that for this 128-byte array, I think we only need one extra page for that. So this is gonna, so we don't actually have enough information to know here. So, but your assumption is we have our heap, it's two pages, right? And you're assuming that the 128-byte array is in the middle of one page or in the middle of another page, and that it doesn't do something like span the middle of two of them. So if that's the case, if it's in the middle of one page, then yes, we need only three physical pages. What would the three physical pages be? We'd have the original copy of the heap in the parent, and for whatever page the array is on, we have a copy of that whole page with modifications in the child. So if the array is, I should probably do this. So if this is our heap, then we'd have in the parent, we'd have the original. In the child, we'd have a modified version of the page that had the array. Which we need that whole page copied because we can't give the processor less than a page to write to. Okay. If we have the scenario where the array spans both of the pages of the heap, it's on the middle, then we need a copy of both of the pages just to change that like 64 bytes that's in each of the two pages. Because all we can do is we can change the whole page. So it's three or four depending on exactly where the array is. Okay, and then we have our stack. So our stack is one virtual page. So who thinks we're gonna need more than one physical page for this, for the stack? So most people, who thinks we're going to need exactly two? Okay, some other number? Okay, so people just aren't willing to say. I would say exactly two. We need a copy of the whole thing because we can't copy less than the whole thing. Right? That's our only option, is to have a copy of the whole page. We can't copy half the page because we can't give the processor a pointer to half the page. Okay, so I add this up and I get that we need, we're going to have 2 plus 1 plus 3 plus 2. That's 5, 6, 8. 8 physical pages or 9 physical pages, depending on where that array was. Some questions on how I figured that out? Okay. So, as I mentioned, our assignment is going to be involved allocating space on demand on the heap. So in XV6, I mentioned we're going to have to do some, I mentioned in general, when we're doing these tricks, we have to do some extra bookkeeping. In XV6, well, what you're going to end up doing is you're going to be already track the size of the program separately from its page table, and you're just going to have sbreak just not change the page table. You're just going to record a new size, and later on, when a page fault happens, you're going to say, should I have allowed this? If I was allocating memory in advance, would this have been fine? And if so, you're going to allocate and finish it. Otherwise, you're not. So this is how we're going to do it in XV6. And other OSs, we're going to actually they would need a much more complicated data structure because, you know, in other OSs, the range of valid memory isn't 0 to some maximum. It has holes, right? That's what we saw on, like, the layout I showed for, like, a typical Linux system. We have these holes. So we're going to have to represent something more complicated. But XV6, we've kept things nice and simple. Also, I mentioned we're going to do copy and write. We have copy and write. We have a bunch of cases. And we saw that, you know, you're going to have to figure out, OK, is it OK, right? We have this same pattern that I showed you when we talked about handling the page fault, which is that we're going to say, is it OK? So for the copy on write case, when we see that the program's trying to write to memory it's not supposed to, we still need to ask, is that memory that I pretended to copy or not? If it's trying to write to, like, the kernel, we need to say, no, don't do that. We don't need to, here, have a copy of the kernel to write to. That's not something we can do. And we need to do bookkeeping about making sure we don't leak memory, making sure we handle, you know, if I make a copy, making sure I realize what happens when I, you know, when I'm working on the only copy anymore. Let me handle that. So questions about allocate on demand, copy on write? Okay, so this is where I got in the other lecture. But I'm going to preview one topic, which we'll talk about next week, along with sort of managing memory in general. And this is something that Linux and Unix have. We're going to talk more about how this works and generally how we manage memory with files. That's a big thing that modern OSs use memory for, is caching files on disk. And something related to this, and another sort of example of a page table trick, is that on Linux and Unix, there's this function called mmap, where you can map a file into your memory. And it makes it appear that part of your memory is literally the file, if you call it in a certain way. So we can make it such that you can read from the file by reading from your memory. You can write to the file by writing to your memory, and it will modify the file, rather than using a write system call. So next time, we'll talk about how this works, and we'll learn that the way Linux has chosen to organize its memory is basically they've just pretended it's a bunch of mmap calls, and they just treat everything as a special case of this make a file appear in your memory scenario. Okay, so that's where I'll finish up today. See you next week.